Attaya pratibodhitam bhagavata narayanena swayam vyasena kratitam purana munina madhye mahabharatam advaitamritavarshinim bhagavatim ashtadashadhyayinim ambatvamanasantatami Bhagavad-gītē-bhagavad-vaiṣṇavam-bhagavad-gītē-bhagavad-vaiṣṇavam-bhagavad-gītē-bhagavad-vaiṣṇavam-bhagavad-gītē-bhagavad-vaiṣṇavam-bhagavad-gītē-bhagavad-vaiṣṇavam-bhagavad-gītē-bhagavad-vaiṣṇavam-bhagavad-gītē-bhagavad-vaiṣṇavam-bhagavad-gītē-bhagavad-vaiṣṇavam-bhagavad-gītē-bhagavad-vaiṣṇavam-bhagavad-gītē-bhagavad-vaiṣṇavam-bhagavad-gītē-bhagavad-vaiṣṇavam-bhagavad-gītē-bhagavad-vaiṣṇavam-bhagavad-gītē-bhagavad-vaiṣṇavam-bhagavad-gītē-bhagavad-vaiṣṇavam-bhagavad-gītē-bhagavad-vai Here, the Adhikaris are really being spoke of, the sannyasis and the karmayogis. There's three people. One is what we call the Uttama Adhikari. The Uttama Adhikari is the one who comes to this teaching completely qualified. For such a person that comes to this teaching with all of those qualifications like viveka, vairagya, the shama, dhamma, upadita, diksha, shraddha, samadhanam, and mumukshutvam, the sadhana, chatushtya, these fourfold qualifications, briefly viveka, the ability to discriminate, dispassion, vairagya, mumukshutvam, the desire to have, to gain moksha, that's the most important one, right? That desire, that burning desire to gain liberation. And also a mind that has shanti, the mind that has enough vairagya, enough inner peace, you know, and single point, ability to be single pointed, such a mind that's just simply sitting at home waiting for this knowledge. So mind that's very mature, they've done all of the work, you know, prior to coming to the knowledge. That person, it's just by Sankhya Yoga. Sankhya Yoga here means by the Sankhya Yoga, that is enough for a person to recognize the self. So hear what it says. Let me just translate this before I go on with it. Dhyanena, by Nididhyasana. Nididhyasana means by the recognizing oneself in contemplation. I'm going to talk more about Nididhyasana in a minute. By dhyana, by Nididhyasana. Kechit pashanti. Some people see, kechit, some people, they see Atmani in the buddhi, in the atma, here in the buddhi, in the mind. Some people say, see in the buddhi, the atma, the self, the atma, the self which is Brahman, the atma, atmana, by means of a mind, atmana, by means of a mind that has antakarna shuddhi. Right? Some people, that mind is the mind of a sannyasi, the mind that has vairagya. It has enough antakarna shuddhi, but such a person is able to recognize the self through Nididhyasana. I'll unfold this in a minute, okay? Anye sankhyena yogena. Others are able to recognize the self with a mind that is mature, with a mind that has antakarna shuddhi. They are able to recognize the self in the buddhi through Sankhya Yoga, just through teaching itself. Sankhya Yoga means to be exposed to this teaching, Shravana and Manana, to the Prakriyas, to the teaching Sampradaya, just to be exposed to this teaching, to the unfoldment of this teaching. For some people, that is all that is required. So some sannyasis who have all of the antakarna shuddhi, all that's required of them is exposure to the teaching. Ramana was like that. We call that an Uttama Adhikari, somebody whose mind is already set. All they need is to hear that teaching, that's enough. That's a sannyasi. Whether it's sannyasi by guna or sannyasi by lifestyle. Guna sannyasa means that you could be living, you're not wearing the orange, but your whole life and attitude is the attitude of a sannyasi. We call that guna sannyasa. Another person has actually taken sannyasa, is wearing the orange, and they're living that lifestyle of sannyasa. That's sannyasa by ritual, they've taken it. But in any case, a sannyasi, one whose mind is absorbed and is ready for it, that knowledge, that teaching itself is enough. But some sannyasis have what they, a pratibandhika, that's called the dehatma buddhi. Everybody anyway has a dehatma buddhi. Dehatma buddhi means the conviction that the body, that the atma is the body, or the body-mind complex. So for some people, even though they listen to this knowledge, listen to the teaching, and understand it, that's all they need is to listen, still they find that because of beginningless samskaras, because of this beginningless identification with the body, it doesn't drop off that quickly. And so even though they have this knowledge very clearly, that dehatma buddhi, that identification with the body, is continually creeping up. And so for such a person, not only shravana, they don't need just shravana, the exposure to this teaching, they need nididhyasana. All of us need nididhyasana. Because nobody's really an uttama adhikari anymore. You need the shravana. Shravana means the exposure to the whole teaching methodology, the exposure to the pramana, to the prakriyas as they're taught. You need the manana. Manana means clearing up any doubts that the shravana should clear up, not only give you the vision of what the Upanishad has to say, but also clear up any doubts around what the Upanishad is actually saying. That's shravana. It's seeing what the Upanishads are saying and getting rid of all doubts about what they are actually saying. So you might say, does the Upanishad, is it saying this or is it saying that? That's a doubt. That has to be cleared up. Manana is where it's not a doubt about what the Upanishad is saying. It's bringing in a doubt that questions the veracity of the Upanishad. If you say there's only one non-dual Atma, I say there are many Purushas that are totally different from this creation. Why can't it be like that? Why is it that the Atma, or that reality is non-dual, is one without a second? So the Upanishads say it's one without a second. Why can't it be like this? That's manana, where you're actually questioning what the Shruti is, the veracity of what the Shruti is saying. That's manana. So shravana, manana has to be done by even any Sankhya, somebody who's studying. Right? Well, all they need to do is study, but they need that clarity. Okay? You can even drop off, perhaps you can even drop off the manana for somebody who's an uttama adhikari because the vision is so clear. When you see it, you see it. And it's not a question of it being like this or that because you see it. That's why they are only bringing in shravana. So for an uttama adhikari, perhaps only shravana. If you have any questions about why can't it be like this or that, that's manana. That's also taken care of by in the teaching itself. Teaching does shravana, manana, and manana. But the dehatma buddhi, for some people, even after seeing so clearly, and even after recognizing your own presence, the mind just continues to fall into that behavior as though I am this body, mind, sense organs behaving in this world. Where the mityatva of the body, mind, sense organs vanishes on you. And so that for that person, dhyanam, nididhyasana, is also needed. What nididhyasana is, here, as Shankara is talking here, there's many types of nididhyasana that we do. But it is bringing your mind again and again to sitting with your own presence, to recognizing again and again who you are. You know, in reference to your body, mind, sense organs, it's withdrawing your sense organs from the world, and then withdrawing the sense organs into the mind, and then having the focus of the mind be on your own presence. Not really different than what we did today. There's so many different meditations, nididhyasana, that we can do to just sit with myself, just to get to know myself, to differentiate myself from all of the experiences that are coming and going. Like I was mentioning, if you just are aware of your body, you'll see that your mind is aware of your, maybe it's aware of your knee, then your shoulder, maybe it's aware of different parts of your body, it's moving around, maybe it's for a moment aware of the whole body. But the mind isn't going to be stable in terms of doing an upasana. We're not trying to do an upasana on the body where you're visualizing the whole body. What you're doing is you're aware of your body and then you're bringing your mind back to your own presence, the one because of whom the body is known. And then you see what you are like, that presence, that me. In reference to every vritti in your mind, all the vrittis are changing, but you're the stable presence of every vritti. What are you like? And so it's giving yourself a chance in contemplation to just be with you, because you're so used to, from beginningless lifetimes, to being with you as the body, to being with you as the body-mind, to being with you as a mood, never to just being with you, to being with yourself, the one because of whom all of these things are known. So this gives your mind a chance, I would say, to come into relationship with you rather than to be you. The mitya mind recognizes its own mityatva and comes into relationship with itself, the conscious me, that is present to every thought without any motion at all. Like, if I had a lump of clay pot, it's not the best, but it's good in some ways. If you think of it like this, if I had a lump of clay and I was moving it into all different kinds of forms, the forms are negating each other, right? Like if I take a lump of clay, and I make it into a square, then I make it into a circle, then I make it into a pot, then I make it into a plate. And doing all kinds of things, these names and forms are continue to negate each other. Right? Like the square is different than the circle, is different than the pot, is different than the plate. When the one is, the other isn't. But no matter what gyrations I go and I do, what type of names and forms, what type of forms I create there, the clay is always the constant. The clayness of the form doesn't modify at all. And so this is true in your own experience. The me goes through no modification ever at any time. You are just conditioned from beginningless time. The mind is conditioned from beginningless time to take this constant presence as itself, even though everything about it is continually changing. And so what we're trying to do, help the mind, is to come into relationship with that constant, to notice it. Rather, to notice the constant being that is the very factor that gives it existence and consciousness. That existence and consciousness doesn't modify. And the thoughts do. So the self doesn't modify, the thoughts modify, and so instead of the mind being totally 100% ignorant of that fact, so that it never even crosses its mind, right? We're asking this mind, your mind, to notice the difference between the changing thought modifications and the constancy of your own presence. Just asking it to notice this. When you notice it, your mind now comes into relationship with something. Now it can depend, because there's a difference. There's a difference between the mitya, the thoughts that are coming and going, and the stable substance being, which is me, in which they're coming and going. It's a difference. We need to notice that difference. Because if we notice that difference, then I can come into relationship, my mind can come into relationship with me, my own presence. That is so beautiful, that is so benign. That's why when I ask these questions, like, what are you like? This presence that is you, what is it like? What words could you use? And then we can say, and this is all nididhyasana, is these kind of questions, these directing the mind to notice this. Is there anything more dear than this present, than the me? There's nothing, it's incomparable. There's nothing that means anything compared to that. That bliss experiences and all of that, that's all fine. In relationship to sorrowful experiences, bliss experiences are great. But they're great in relationship to the lesser or more negative experiences. But they're nothing in reference to me. the bliss experience in me, in my own being, they're non-comparables. They're non-comparables. And so that's a comparison to make. Just to recognize that there is something in my experience that is non-negatable, non-objectifiable, and is the beloved, that there is nothing more than that. When the mind recognizes that, then it has a safe harbor. Its safe harbor is the adhishtana, is its adhishtana. The adhishtana is that which allows the mithya to be. The adhishtana of the pot is the clay. The adhishtana of the snake is the rope. The adhishtana of my mind is me, the conscious being. And so, when the teaching is taking place for an uttama adhikari, one whose mind is highly matured, that is recognized. That relationship is recognized. That satyam mithya is recognized. The freedom of my being is recognized. Now, having recognized that, you may find day in and day out that this dehatma buddhi, this identification with the body and mind, keeps coming up. And so then you do nididhyasana to break that habitual response. That's what nididhyasana is for. It's to own up, to give the mind a chance to own up what you've recognized at the time of teaching. And so then he says, Others need to do karma yoga. And doing karma yoga, they also do the sankhya, they expose themselves to the teaching, but they need to do the karma yoga because that viveka, vairagya, the shama, dhamma, the mumukshutvam, all of these things are not matured to a high enough degree yet. I still have raga dvesha. There's still things in the world I need. I need things to be a certain way. I have inner child work to do. I have complexes. You know, I have likes and dislikes. My mind gets upset and irritated. My mind needs some time to mature. In spite of my mumukshutvam, in spite of my exposure to this teaching, in spite of my doing nididhyasana, I've very much drawn in this way or that way by the world. So raga, dvesha, likes and dislikes are there. So for that person, which is all of us, we do karma yoga. You know, karma yoga is, you know, complex. We've spent a lot of time working on karma yoga, but basically karma yoga is, along with with exposure to this teaching, with doing the sankhya, along with the nididhyasana, I live in the world. I don't take sannyasa. It's difficult. It's difficult to have a lot of raga dvesha, likes and dislikes, and you won't need the world to be like this or that, or you want to accomplish this or that, and then you take sannyasa. If you're an Indian, you take sannyasa, you have to wear this orange, and you're really only allowed to study the shastra, to teach, to have satsang, to contemplate and to eat. That's what you do. Eat and bathe. That's what you do.
That's where they get all big.
You do more than this, and you're really not a sannyasi. Okay? You're doing all these things, I mean, from an outside view. Somebody will look at you, you know, this person's supposed to be a sannyasi, and look what they're doing. In India, they're very gossipy like that. And you'll also feel, I'm supposed to be a sannyasi, but, you know, and doing all of these other things, it doesn't feel right for an Indian. For us, if we take sannyasa, that's a whole different thing. That's a whole different problem. So the whole Bhagavad Gita, what Krishna has to say is, you don't take sannyasa, let the sannyasa take you. You don't take the sannyasa, let the sannyasa take you. It means for you, there is nothing else to do. You're already a sannyasi, then you take sannyasa. Right? Or you're so, all that you have to do and all that you want to do, you want to study. You just want to study and you want to contemplate, you want to be with a teacher. That's it. You don't want to do anything else. That's what we call vividisha sannyasa. You take sannyasa because you have that vairagya complete and the only thing you want to do is study to gain this knowledge and then become what's called a vidvat sannyasa. That's the real sannyasa. Vidvat sannyasa is the sannyasa is the sannyasa of knowledge. The person who has knowledge is a sannyasi. So vidvat means the one who knows. The sannyasi is the one who vidvat, has knowledge. Or you can take vividisha sannyasa. You're ready to take sannyasa. You don't need the karma yoga and all of that. You don't want to have to practice karma yoga in the ashram. But we all do. We all do so. But the ashram's only for 3 years. Say if we go to study with Swamiji, you study for 3 years. So, and then you get out. He doesn't let people stay. You get out. And then go live in the world. You know? Or go directly from there into a sannyasi life if you're ready for that. But you want always to be in an environment that is conducive, the most conducive to jnana nishtha, to becoming rooted in this knowledge. So that's what Arjuna's whole problem was this. I don't want to stay in the middle of this battlefield and fight this war. I want to go to the Himalayas and be with the sannyasis and gain this knowledge. Why don't you, and he asked Krishna over and over again, why don't you think that would be good for me now? Let me leave this battlefield. He wasn't a chicken or coward or anything like that. He just couldn't figure out how to really gain this knowledge. And Krishna has said throughout the Gita in so many ways, you gain this teaching and you stay here. You know, doing whatever karmas are there to be done. All of your duties, you stay here in your situation. You do all of your duties to the best of your ability as with that Ishwara Arpana Buddhi. All of them with Shraddha as devotion or worship of Ishwara. And you take all of the fruits of your action as prasad from me. And in that way, you neutralize all of your likes and dislikes. And so that Karma Yoga Buddhi, really, he mentions that here, it really stands for all of the sadhanas we do in terms of living in the world to neutralize our likes and dislikes. Remember, a likes and dislike is, that's exactly what it is. I need this to be happy. And I'm not getting it, and so I'm upset. And not only am I not getting it, which is making me upset, you're not helping me get it, so now I'm upset with you too. You know? And then you were helping me get it, and I liked you when you were helping me get it, but now you're not helping me, and I don't like you either. It goes, what do you call, like a ball of rolling stone or something that's going to turning into a huge, huge mud ball at the bottom of the mountain. So these raga dveshas are natural, and they're the antithesis of the truth of our life. Absolutely natural, because the adhyasa, the superimposition onto the world, let me have this so that I can be happy, is natural. It's the natural effect of ajnanam. And so when you gain self-knowledge, recognizing that the very ananda that I was trying to squeeze out of the world is my own nature, it would be nice if all of the samskaras that we had developed from beginningless time would just drop off, but they don't. They hang on, and they have to rise and work themselves out in the light of who I am now with my knowledge. And so that takes whatever time it takes. So until that vairagya is there, that viveka vairagya, that dispassion. And dispassion just means that simply, it's nothing negative about dispassion. Just means that I don't need this to be in a particular way in order for me to be happy. My ananda is not dependent upon the world. That doesn't mean I don't like the world or that I don't enjoy the world, that I don't have preferences. But the presence or absence of a preference or the presence or absence of a non-preference, something I don't want, isn't an issue in terms of my wholeness or well-being. That's vairagya. That's a huge thing. You know, you have to have vairagya toward the whole world, toward everything, toward your body, toward your mind, toward your thoughts, toward your moods, toward your emotions, toward your little ones inside. Vairagya is not a dismissal. It's an acceptance. It's so important. It's an acceptance. It's an objectivity. It's allowing you to be with what is. That's vairagya. It's not a pushing away. Vairagya allows me to be present to what is and to come into relationship with what is in a kind way. I say in a kind way. Because your swarupa, the atma, by its nature, is kind. It's not an act, doing an act of kindness. Its swarupa, its nature is ananda. The manifestation of ananda is kind. And so that's who you are. So when you're behaving differently, you're not being objective. There is raga dvesha intervening there. Your likes and dislikes are intervening there. Otherwise, there's no reason to get upset. I can handle the situation objectively. So you notice yourself, so much of the time, the great, great percentage of your time, you are kind. Kind, I don't mean some effusive bliss ball. I mean just normal. Not human beings are not hostile. You're not hostile at your core. You're not confronted at your core. You like to give. You like to help. That's your very nature. And so when these things are, when other things are thwarting you, then that becomes, that's a sadhana. And we should have a mind, we should be in a situation in our life where those situations that can be disturbing will come up. We should be there. That's where we should be. Because otherwise they're lurking around inside. Waiting. They're just waiting. Like I've told the story so many times that after I was in India for all those years, the beginning, it's been 2 or 3 years before I came home. I came home not remembering, I had a totally different mind, an Indian mind, that had been having shravana day in and day out for 3 years or whatever. And I came home and concerns and thoughts and irritations that I hadn't experienced for 3 years were just waiting there. When I came back into the same situation with the same people, parents, friends, whatever, just situations, old situations, the same thoughts came. They came into a new person. Means a more mature mind, a mind that had knowledge. But they came, and they were identical. They had just been dormant there. They needed the proper situation to sprout. And so they did. They all did. It shocked me. So we don't want to have a mind that's not free. You want to be in your situation and be free in your situation. If you can be free in your situation, that's fine. That's a wonderful thing. And then you learn how to be free. Free in your situation means a lot of different things. It also means being able to be free with the mind that you have. Free means vairagya. Okay, this is the situation. So I can have vairagya toward the situation, means I can deal with it objectively. And this is my mind. I can be with my mind and I can deal with it with vairagya objectively. I have an opportunity to learn all of this stuff. To train my mind, to let my mind mature in the light of my knowledge. That's why it's so important. Swamiji would always say a couple of times, I remember especially that I wanted to run away from a situation. I even wanted to quit my job once at CIS because it was just too difficult, too many difficult people. One person in particular that was such a, making things so difficult. He said, you can quit after that problem's over. Now that, for years now, that person's been a friend of mine, actually. But, he's told me that over the years, maybe two or three times, maybe more times, but two or three times that were significant times. till finally I kind of got the message. You know, you just don't leave a situation because you don't like it. You know, be careful about that. You know, especially, you know, make big lifestyle changes because you don't like, can't handle being in the company of that person or whatever. Be careful. Because actually that person can be your greatest sadhana. Why is that person able to do that to you? But sometimes, I mean, that, what I'm saying is not easy. Sometimes it's easy, but if it's easy, it's not a problem. Sometimes it's really not easy to do that, you know. Sometimes it's not an easy thing at all. But it's worth contemplating, because actually it's your problem. No matter how horrible you think the person is, your situation, they can be really horrible. They could be a really horrible person. All of that's true. It could be horrible. It could be a totally horrible situation. But that it's horrible for you is your problem.
What?
That it's horrible for you is your problem. There are so many things that are horrible that are not horrible for you. So why is this horrible thing horrible for you? That's the thing. It's very interesting to look at it and to actually give yourself some contemplative time around what's going on with you that makes you unable to accommodate this person, horrible or not. You really have to think of it like that, because for mumukshu, when we're talking about a mumukshu, you know, these are the problems, these are the sadhanas. The other thing, what else is the sadhana? You do shravana, manana, nididhyasana to gain this, you know, satsang. Shravana, manana, nididhyasana, and satsang. To gain this knowledge. So that can be taken care of. And then you have the antakarana shuddhi, the purity of mind. So what is going to be the sadhana for that? It's not going to be staying in, hidden in a room with the door closed. That's not a sadhana. That's just nididhyasana time. You know what I mean? It's not a sadhana. So you need, all of the world becomes a sadhana for you until it isn't. That's how we can look at it, and that makes everything really interesting and meaningful. It means everything you do is meaningful. And the more you understand that karma yoga buddhi, you even take each moment that you have as that Ishwara Arpana buddhi, as your, each moment is your prarabdha. Each moment is Ishwara. And here you are as a jiva, this body, mind, sense organs, in Ishwara's, in this moment of Ishwara. And so what are you going to do in this moment that you have with Ishwara? Are you going to get mad at him? Or berate him, or tell him, you know, what a total loser he is. What are you going to do? In fact, honestly, if that's what you're doing, berating Ishwara, telling him what a loser he is, and how horrible he could put you in this situation, and what good are you anyway for making this type of situation for me? I can't even stand you. I don't even want to be with you anymore. Why are you even here? What are you doing? If you go on and on like that, Bhagavan would say, you are such a great devotee of me. You are my greatest devotee, because even when you're mad at me, you cannot think about anything else but me. You are a great devotee. There's stories like that. You are the great devotee. Because you're never not thinking of me. You're either loving me, or you're angry at me, you know, or you're pleased with me, or you're disgusted with me. But it's all about me. That is perfect. You are a great devotee. So that relationship with Ishwara, you know, is such an important thing for gaining that antakarana shuddhi. Also recognizing if you recognize every moment as Ishwara, then every moment you're related to Ishwara. Every morning, every moment is your prarabdha karma unfolding. Your prarabdha karma is Ishwara. And so every moment is a moment with Ishwara. And so then your moment, how are you going to handle that moment? So that's what that Ishwara Arpana Buddhi. Another way of looking at this also is to recognize that this mind is limited. The mind of the jiva is limited. The mind of the jiva, the individual mind, of this upadhi, this individual mind, is part and parcel of your infinite mind. Because the self that you are is Ishwara. Right? The self that you are is the self of Ishwara. That means that there's only one self. That means this body, mind, sense organs is part and parcel, in terms of a creation, it's part and parcel of Ishwara. So you can look at Ishwara as an infinite manifest knowledge, infinite intelligence. Whose infinite intelligence is it? Yours, the Atma. This infinite intelligence is your infinite intelligence. What is this mind? This mind is your limited intelligence within the infinite intelligence. You see? Like if you have a dream, you are the total dream, okay? You are the Ishwara of the dream. You are the self of the dream, and so the dream comes from you, is sustained by you, is resolves back into you. It is a manifestation of your knowledge, the whole dream. Within that dream, you may be identified with a character in the dream. That character in the dream is also you. Because the manifestation of the whole dream includes that character who is living out their prarabdha karma moment by moment by moment as part and parcel of the whole dream. The maya of the whole dream is my maya, as Brahman, as myself. And so I am the self of this infinite intelligence that is me, and I am the self of all of the little limited intelligences that make up, that are part of the infinite intelligence. So here, this body, mind, sense organs, as part of this prarabdha, this story that we're experiencing now through this shared prarabdha between us, there's the prarabdha of Ishwara, Ishwara's prarabdha, of which we are all a part. And then there's my opinion of it. Whether I think this is good for us, or is this the right thing that should be happening now, or could we do it a little bit better, or maybe if I did this way or that way, that would be superior. So that's an interesting play. I find, personally, after being with this, experiencing this for so many years, or whatever, I like to give credence to the infinite intelligence and then see my place in it. See what my place is in it. But not dismiss the infinite intelligence for my opinion, as though my opinion comes first. I'm talking about disregarding my opinion or what I think, or what I want to do, but to just go for your opinion without recognizing that you're part of a greater whole is very limiting. I find that very, very limiting. You become like just a little person in a concrete world, rather than the little person that you are in an infinite world, which is your own being, which is your own projection, which is Ishwara, which is you. You see what I mean? It's a totally different way of relating. And so, when that's the case, then the limited salutes or does namaskar to the limitless. There's a certain different type of trust or different type of relationship. The reason you can do all of this, really, to be honest, whether it says this in the Shruti itself, you can do all of this because your being, what you seek, is what you are. not even Ishwara can take away the wholeness that you seek. Ishwara can't do anything about it. You don't depend upon Ishwara for moksha. Yourself is the self of Ishwara. See what I mean? And so there's no... You may depend upon Ishwara for moksha with your prayers for antakarna shuddhi, to gain a teacher or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But Ishwara can't take away yourself. The self that you are is the self that Ishwara is. Ishwara can't take away your prarabdha. Your prarabdha is there. It's all Ishwara. There's nothing to be taken away or nothing to be damaged, and there's nothing that can ever be done to your own being or to take away your own ananda. Can't be done. Nobody can do it. And it doesn't exist out here anyway. Right? It's my own being. You think it exists out here, it doesn't. It's a superimposition. That's why everything that you fall in love with or want so badly, you know, all of that ananda drips off. And you're just left with a thing. Or you're just left with a person. You learn to love people for what they are, enjoying your own being. Yeah. Otherwise, everybody would be getting divorced all the time. You know, I love you. I'm so in love with you. Oh my God, how was I ever in love with you? Oh, I'm so in love with you. I don't even like you. Oh, I like you so much. It's on and on and on. That's how stuff you give up all of that. That's why in India, you know, with these arranged marriages, because they have an arranged marriage, they have an attitude, this is my partner, period. I don't need to love you, I don't need to like you, I can be mad at you, we're married. That's it, we're married. It's not about raga dvesha, it's not about loving or not loving, you know, it's about you, we're together. And then that's it. They're very, very clear on that. That's a nice attitude toward life itself. This is it. It's not about loving it or not loving it, or being happy or not, you know, all of this stuff. But this is it. And for a jnani, that's how it is. This is it. And this is it. This is the Ishwara. This is the moment, you know. And myself is depending on my own ananda for fullness, rather than projecting that ananda on the world and making a mess of it. So that's the difference between knowledge and ignorance, really. And that karma yoga for mumukshu, that karma yoga helps the mind to, it gives it a structure to allow for it to naturally mature in the light of this knowledge. Because that karma yoga buddhi is totally, it's just telling you how to be in this world in a way that you will realize is natural for you as you gain knowledge. It's giving you an attitude with Ishwara, even though there's at that time, there's still me as the doer, you know, as the jiva, worshipping Ishwara, the creation, holding an attitude that actually mimics or is so very close to what it will be like when I just realize I am Ishwara and this whole thing is Ishwara. So it's making the jiva so thin, this attitude makes the jiva so thin, you know, that the mind is just ready for this knowledge. And so we practice that karma yoga buddhi until the mind, you know, works out its raga dveshas and comes to mature whatever degree it needs to, so that it can just resolve all of these problems once and for all. And so here, that's why he says, you know, some people, there's some of us, it's just through teaching alone. Others, sannyasi. Others, sannyasis, it's just through teaching and nididhyasana to get rid of this dehatma buddhi. For others, it's this teaching, always the song, always the teaching, and the nididhyasana, together with karma yoga. For those people, you don't take sannyasa yet because it will limit the karma yoga. You don't want to put a limitation on karma yoga. So don't take sannyasa yet until the only thing that you want to do is study and teach. That there's nothing else that needs to be done. Till then you do the karma yoga. So this is complete. There's nothing else to be said here. You know, in terms of how to go about getting into this position of seeing yourself. Now, seeing, that's one more thing we have to go into here. It says pashyanti. Some people, they pashyanti, they see Buddha in the buddhi, atmani, in the buddhi, the atma, the self, by means of the mind. Okay? By the mind means through vritti. But now, to understand what that is, the self is the self, yourself, the atma, is the self of every vritti. That self of every is the self of every vritti. Every vritti goes on changing, but its content, the self, is the constant. And so what has to happen is that in the buddhi, which the self is the self of every thought in the buddhi, okay, that mind has to differentiate through the teaching, the constant in the buddhi, which is me, from the changing vrittis. It has to make that differentiation. So that is seeing. Like all this teaching going on, I have to, as the teaching is going on, and when I do nididhyasana, guided meditations and all of these things, the words have to help me to recognize my own presence, which is there present to every single vritti. And so that's why it's so important. It's not as though in every vritti that you have, yourself isn't its self. It is itself. But the vrittis can be of, like this room. And when I'm just looking at this room with my eyes, I now have myself, which is the substance of the vritti, plus all of the forms of the room, all of the colors, whatever I'm perceiving. What I need to be able to do is recognize my presence, the conscious being that I am, in this vritti, alone, without all of the colors, so that I can know that I exist without all of the colors. I need to know that this display is not, that I am the self of this display of color and am absolutely free and present with or without the display. So I can withdraw my sense organs so that this color, this picture is no longer here because I'm withdrawing my sense organs. And instead of just a blank mind, I'm letting the mind just focus on its own content. So then I become naked, absolutely free of any objectifiable form at all. And I'm just me. And I realize then that I am free, that my being is not dependent on anything. It's not dependent on this body. It's not dependent on the sense organs. It's not dependent on the mind. It's not dependent on the universe. But it's the very self of all of these things. And it never goes away, never changes, and never can change. There's nothing you can do about it. That's why I said for a moment in the meditation, forget about Brahman, forget about Atma, all of these words, and just try to notice you, the me that you take yourself to be right now. Not the different thoughts or the perceptions of your body and things that are coming and going. Just you. Just notice your own presence. That you already now, without any knowledge, you already take it to be you. Now try to get rid of it. You just try to get rid of it. You can get rid of thoughts. You can get rid of perceptions. But you can't get rid of you. Never. If you can get rid of it, it's just a thought. And you're working too hard. You're working too hard because the you is the you you all have always taken yourself to be. It's nothing new. It's so not new. It's the only problem. It's not a problem of recognizing you. It's that you always thought that you were dependent on this body. When this body dies, I'll die. When this thought is upset, I'm upset. That's the problem. Not the self-recognition. The self-recognition is fine. It's true. It's just that you've put a lot of baggage on it. So now just throwing away all of the words, just notice that me. And if you can't get rid of it, then that's Brahman. When you're walking around, just notice that it's still there. Is it still there? Can I get rid of it? And you'll start realizing that, no, there's absolutely nothing I can do. I'm always there. Nobody can do anything to me. Even if you have a negative thought, a hurt thought, an angry thought, that's a good time to say, am I still there? Yes. A freaked out thought, am I still there? Yes, I'm still there. Not covered at all. Not covered at all. That is Brahman. Not covered, it's not possible. It's not possible for the pot to cover the clay. You just have to notice who is always there. Then you ask yourself, am I covered? Get a bliss vritti, a really happy bliss vritti. Then you ask, am I still there? That's a good one. Am I still there? Always ask, am I still there? And you see, you're not covered. And that's Brahman. That's such a relief to see that. Okay. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om. Hi, Nello. Hi, Lita. Hi, Dechen.
Maybe you could help me a little bit with this. If you know that all the material in the universe is Ishwara,
mm-hmm.
and the karma is playing out in my life, in the my life here in the jiva.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm a part of his story, how do you really sense that? I mean, do I see everything is divine and everything is him, or what's the approach to make that more alive?
You know, I think one way that is really helpful is that a lot of times if we look backwards at our life, we see all the synchronicity, all of the plans, you know, all of the planned development of your life, that you had no clue of as you were going through the life. But when you look back, you see how one thing led to another, led to another, led to another. All of the interconnectedness becomes something that you understand looking backward. Mm-hmm. It takes a while before you appreciate the interconnectedness of everything and trust in the present and trust the movement forward. Mm-hmm. That there's a plan that's much bigger than you. Mm-hmm. That you're playing a part in a much bigger picture, you know. We have that, often have that shraddha, looking backwards, but very rarely looking forward. Looking forward, there's a lot of fear and all of that, until there isn't. Until you start, as the freer you become, and again, it goes back to the self-interest of the recognition that nothing can happen to me in the end, now or ever. Nothing can happen to my being. Nothing can take the ananda away from me. I own the freedom, the indestructible nature of myself. The more I understand that, the more I recognize myself as pervasive to all of this, that all of this is me. You know, just from so much teaching and so much understanding, so much contemplation, the freer you are, you know, to see a bigger picture that you're playing a part in, and to enjoy it. And you can't really enjoy it when you want something else. Like say, I don't want this story. I want so-and-so's story. I want another story.
Yeah.
Then it's hard. Right? But I think it's helpful initially to look backward and to see the unfoldment of your life and kind of the story and how many things had to come together to get to you to where you are now.
So that'll flower more into this.
It helps you. Well, if there's a story going backwards, there must be a story going forwards. If I can see that, I can see the story going backwards, but I'm not willing to see the story going forward. There comes a time when you can relax and kind of enjoy the story going forward, because there's no way that there's not one. You know, there's no way. Your life, until you die, and then you'll either be Ishwara or you'll take another birth. So there is no end. You see what I mean? Like, even if you die, that story is going to continue. You're going to continue. And to say, if you're not talking about, say, up to death, this life is going to be unfolding, right?
Yeah, see, but I always think that I'm going to be the author of the story in the future rather than, I mean, that's tricky right there.
I would say that it would be impossible to be the author, really, because there's so too many variables. You can have some impact on your life, but how much, really? You can have a lot of impact on your attitude. A lot of impact. But how much impact on your life? It's an interesting... You can make a mess of your life attitudinally. I think that's really true. Yeah. And you can clean it up also.
Well, when you were speaking about... when we have situations in our life that are very... very difficult, and then we see it as was Bhagavan, and I don't like that, what he just did,
mm-hmm.
he or she just did. And but I think with maturity, you don't do that anymore, because you know it's a background complex, really.
You mean you don't start keep getting angry at Ishwara?
Right, because yeah. You know it's a complex, really.
Well, I don't think you keep getting angry at Ishwara, but the reason is because you're not asking Ishwara to be different. You know, but there's a big difference between a person who's getting angry at Ishwara and a person that could care less about Ishwara. That's the point of that story. See, as you don't need the world to be in a particular way for you to be happy, then you can really enjoy your prarabdha and live out your prarabdha and be helpful and do what needs to be done in your prarabdha. Okay, but until that time, you know, you always have your prarabdha.
Yeah.
And you have your prarabdha and you're not happy in it. Right?
I think I'm talking about the split off of the Christian God, you know, that like anything that happens if Bhagavan gives the good, makes the tears and also dries the tears, right? As in Buddha, then I think it's still a mix up of the God punishing God versus the
The Christian God.
That's the complexity I'm speaking about.
But you know what? That's such a huge freedom to get over that one. So let me, because we as even the whole Judeo-Christian lineage. I think the Jewish is a little bit better than the Christian because Yahweh is both. He has both sides.
Well, I don't know. They have their own guilt trip.
Yeah, they do. They have their own problems. But if you're Christian, the good is God. And the bad is the devil, you know. And God can be a very punishing God. But in India, when you start to understand that, it's such a relief. It's like, Ishwara is Ishwara. The karmas, you take this birth, it's a result of your own karmas. You know, and so it's not a punishing God. It's karmas.
It's what you deserve, right?
Yeah, it's your karmas, and then you can do rituals and whatnot, prayaschitta karmas, to try to neutralize those karmas. But it's not all on God's shoulders.
Mm.
Whereas, say you don't believe, you've had this one birth for no reason, there's no prior karma, and you have one life, and then you go to heaven or hell.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it. No reason for the inequality, and then as you're living your life, punishing, bad things happen. Why? What have you done for those bad things to happen?
Well, God's then punishing. You can be angry, really angry at God.
Yeah, I suppose, but God is God punishing you?
Yeah.
You know? He's punishing, God punishes the wicked. This is fundamentalist Christians. God punishes the wicked and rewards the good people. Therefore, listen to this language. God punishes the wicked people and he rewards the good people. Therefore, we should not do anything for the people who are suffering because we should not interfere with God's punishment. I have that in writing. That's one logic that's used. That's an amazing logic. That says, you know, all of these, any religion that you take, you can take any belief system to an extreme. You can take it to a point of absurdity. And then somebody will believe that. And somebody will be there for it.
And that's something about their karma from a previous life that would make them a fundamentalist.
We would say, actually, that's all very complex, but say the karma from a previous life would put you in a situation that, say, you were born of fundamentalist parents, or you were born, you know, of Hindu parents, or you were born of Buddhist parents. That would have something to do, very much have something to do with your prarabdha karma. The situation that you find yourself in, the parents, the time and place, the culture, the family, then important events in the life, that's all the prarabdha karma. Now, how you're put in a situation where it's easy to go along with the status quo than not, but you have a choice. There's free will there, but the free will is, you know, taking place in an environment which is more conducive to you going along with what they're doing than going along, than rubbing up against it. It's just like some child who works, who goes to end up going all through school and becomes a great scientist or whatever, and a really good person is born in a ghetto, and all of his or her friends are just gang members. You know, that's not a very conducive situation, right? But then that person lives a different kind of life in that type of a situation. It's the same. You can be born in a highly religious or spiritual family and don't go that way at all. But you've been given that situation. So that's the interesting thing with the prarabdha, prarabdha and free will. If the prarabdha always influences the free will, how could it not? Because you're in the situation of the prarabdha. So the two are very much hand in hand. But free will is free will. It doesn't rule out, it doesn't get rid of the prarabdha, but within the prarabdha there's free will. Does that make sense?
But the prarabdha is not punishment, right? It's not like consequences.
Consequences. Yeah, what is a natural unfoldment of the continuation of your life? Like a good way to think of the prarabdha karma is if you understand, like, your life, like when I say the story is kind of unfolding, that's an unfoldment of karma. And it's a natural unfoldment. This leads to this, leads to this, leads to this. And there's probably so many complexity of laws and everything that are combining here to make that flow be taking place. So many karmas flowing into that. But it seems so natural. So just extend that beyond one life, to another life, to another life, to another life, and see it as a flow of karma that takes into account not just you. The karmas are interconnected with the whole situation that you find yourself in, right? So actually the prarabdha karma is just not your body, mind, sense organs. It's the whole situation that you find yourself in is part of the karma. And there's everything's interconnected with everything else. Like our karmas right now are intersecting. You know, we're all sharing this kind of we're all part of this collective karma. We're all moving through. Our prarabdha karma is all intertwined here.
And do you have any choice about whether you come back again or not?
You don't have any choice. Once you gain knowledge and the ignorance is removed, you know, then there's not any coming back. Because there's no one to come back. The Atma has never come back. The self that you are is the self that you are. And if that Ajnanam is there, you can't really, the ignorance is removed, you can't really get that back. You know, if getting it back, kind of like if I use the example as if I have mistaken a rope for a snake. Once I see the rope, I can't get that Maya back to make that snake there. And so once the mind is mature and that the self is the you are the self, you are the Atma, you know, that everything else is mitya for you, you can't not be the self. You can't get back there.
Well, what if the Dehatma Buddhi is still...
Then you'll probably take another birth.
Well, that is coming back.
Yeah, but it means that if the Dehatma Buddhi is there and Raga Dvesha or something is there to enough degree to pull you back, then you'll take another birth and you'll just take another few years to mature.
Sorry, what does the Dehatma Buddhi mean again?
The Buddhi here is like the conviction that the Atma, the self, is the body. A Dehatma Buddhi means I keep mistaking my Atma, myself. Yeah, superimposition. Yeah.
So what's the trick then, right before you die? When you gotta...
I'm Brahman now. There's no trick. There's no shortcut. There's not something to worry about. We've been here beginningless time. Who cares?
inner child practices and a lot of the stuff that you've taught us, technically they don't fit in that, you know, very technical definition of karma yoga. But in the spirit of this particular verse, they seem to have the similar function, a similar goal, a similar outcome when you do them. But
I think it does really fit in. Like that karma, that doing that inner child work is re-raising those little ones with love, you know. And that's what they need. They need to be freed like that. So it's not the little child is doing karma yoga. And in a way, maybe you're not doing exactly karma yoga, you're taking care. It's like if you had children out here in the real world, how you would want them to be able to grow, you know? You give that to your own child, little child inside that didn't... And no child gets it everything. And parents just fail continually, poor things. They do their best. We all parents fail, you know, because you can't, you just can't be a perfect parent. Even if you're doing your utmost, the child can have this hurt or that hurt. You know, so whatever hurts are there inside, then we learn how to be with those to release them.
If this verse were written in the contemporary West, it would probably include the karma yoga.
Oh, I see what you mean. That in yes, the yes, 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 exactly. Exactly.
And so for us to think of it that way.
Yes, yeah, that's right. Okay. Perfect.
Wait, what was it?
The karma yoga, for us when we're teaching all about karma yoga and everything, we're also talking about inner child work, how to be with the little ones. That's all part of that, what we do to gain that inner, that purity of mind. Yeah.
So the complexes are part of I am the body. I mean, if there's...
The I am the body is really ignorance. Self-ignorance.
But there can be inner child work there that's incomplete, that is a complex. Is that an unapadi also that you can identify wrongly with?
Well, in a little different way, because the hurts of the little child inside overwhelm the conscious mind. And then you take that to be you.
Yeah.
Whereas what you learn in doing inner child work is if a complex, an anger or hurt comes up and overwhelms the mind, then your buddhi knows how to say, talk to it and say, okay, what's really, tell me what this really is about, what's really hurting you. And let that hurt talk to you. Who's really hurt now? What's really happened? Because that you can, you know, when you're having some big reaction in the world or towards somebody, it's not current. There's something, someone inside who's very upset. And so if you know that, you can just immediately to yourself go and say, you know, okay, what's really bothering you? What's really hurting you? And let those parts talk. Mm-hmm. And then be with them, you know. Mm-hmm. Because especially, you know, the more knowledge you get and the more mature you get just as a person, more experienced you get with life and all of that, the less the world is able to rile you up. It's just not worth it, you know. And so when you get really riled or really hurt or really upset, there's something else going on too. If that something else wasn't going on, you might be hurt or angry or something, but it's not a big deal. You can handle it. But when it's a huge thing, there's someone inside that's hurt. And then you need to, it's such, so helpful if you know how to handle that, how to go in and be with that little one inside, to listen, to find out what's really going on, you know, to hear the whole problem, to know what's really bothering, and for that one to know that you're there and that you care and that you love that little one. And respect. Let love and respect. Love, like, respect. Give the benefit of the doubt. Yeah.
This, you know, prasada buddhi, can it come, you know, naturally from jnana, as opposed to necessarily from deliberate, you know, karma yoga.
Yeah, from knowledge. Yeah, it comes naturally.
Because
from
then,
knowledge.
You know, once you see the self, then how do you account for all
this is
Ishwara, stuff happening? You know,
it has to be Ishwara. Yeah, that's right. It comes very naturally. some people, you know, different. Karma yoga is just how to deal with the world when that isn't coming naturally.
Mm-hmm.
But when that, it's also an effect of knowledge. Understanding right. all of this as Ishwar is an effect of knowledge.
So it's like karma yoga can actually be like an effect of knowledge in a certain way, right? Or the prasada buddhi, basically.
The prasada buddhi yeah. is natural. Mm-hmm. But the karma yoga is used mm-hmm. when the karta is there, the doer
oh, okay.
comes in. Right. That's when karma yoga comes in.
Okay.
Because yeah. what karma yoga tells you is exactly what you gain naturally at knowledge, with knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But just like you did nididhyasana, you do nididhyasana to neutralize the identification with the body, which is also natural, you know, until you really know.
Mm-hmm.
That karma yoga is what you do when mm-hmm. raga dveshas are there,
mm-hmm.
you know, or in order to help the mind just see all of this as Ishwara.
As a kind of fake it till you make it.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah, a little bit like that, even though it's not exactly a fake it.
Right, right.
You know?
Oh, so we don't need karma yoga then?
You don't need it if you don't have any raga dvesha and you don't want the world to be different. You're free, you don't need anything. You're just a jiva mukta. You have jnana nishta, and we all salute you.
You look so happy.
Really, I do.
Just resting in the amendment.
Yeah.
Carol, it seems like there's a, for someone who's not quite at that
yeah,
exalted level.
Like Edward.
No, I wasn't.
We can't all be at that level. But, that there's some level of skill in to develop in knowing when to do prasada buddhi, when to do inner child, when to do like relax into what's happening.
You know what? That's true, and you have to see where you're at any given moment, and you have all of these different tools or ways of being that are available to you. Do you do what's appropriate for you at the time?
Karma yoga is a pretty good fallback position, though.
Karma yoga becomes
if you don't know what to do.
Yeah, karma yoga is natural.
No, it seems like attitude is a big thing here.
Yeah. Attitude,
and
is
then
a big
the ultimate
thing.
Attitude is knowing you're the Atma.
The ultimate attitude is yeah, knowing you're the Atma, knowing that this is Ishwara, that I am Ishwara, and all the repercussions of that. That takes. You know, your mind keeps sorting that out, what it means for me to be Ishwara in reference to every moment. That this is myself, you know.
Do you think the Indian culture has an advantage over others if they seen this all as Ishwara, or are they...
Well, you know, Swamiji's talked about that in a way that I think I agree. I mean, I understand what he's saying. There are advantages and disadvantages to everything. The disadvantage is that in India, just like here, if you grow up as a Jew or Christian, you can totally take all of that for granted, a layman's understanding. Okay, I grew up as a Christian. Just a lay person's understanding, by osmosis, you get all of this stuff. But you don't really know anything, and then you think you know. You don't know anything. And it's the same in India. They know all of this without knowing anything. You know, it's like osmosis. It's all there and all part of the culture and everything. But it's so much there that they tend to take it for granted, which is their disadvantage. The advantage is they've been grown up in all of that, and they just have it in their pores, and they have Sanskrit and Hindi, which is all these Sanskrit cognates, and they have all of the Vedas and Upanishads. They know what all of this is. That's a huge, wonderful thing. And also just being born in a culture that resonates more clearly with how things actually are. That's a positive. And the negative is that a lot of it's taken for granted. And so then say when Swamiji's teaching and all of the words are familiar, but they're familiar, and so they've all been misdefined.
You can see the forest for the trees.
Yeah. All of the definitions are definitions that take place within duality, whereas a Westerner comes, and everything is fresh. And so that's the advantage that we have. The disadvantage is that you know, we've been born and raised in a culture that is very askew in many ways from Dharma. They're not completely. You know, it's maybe farther removed from an environment that is easier for being a human being in. Who knows?
Mm. Now, along those lines, could you say that generally we in the West are more psychologically messed up than in India?
Not anymore.
If they've been infected by...
So infected by invasion of the
West.
Like
a virus.
And now, you know, now you can't say much of anything, because even when I was there in the early 70s, there were a few movie theaters here and there that you could go and see some movie that was old. Now the movies we see here today are there, right now. Television is there. So,
well, that stuff, and that is a huge thing. And it seems that at an even more fundamental level is the child-rearing practices. And that's going to shape someone even more profoundly.
That is true. I think the child-rearing practices are still much better than ours, from my experience of the group of Indians that I experience. You know, there's a lot of Indians that aren't within this kind of Swamiji circle.
Well, you.
Only a few billion.
You've been surrounded by classical type Indians,
yeah,
not
very traditional Indians, but you know. But I know some other Indians too, and then their child-rearing practices are still so. They probably have their shadow side, but you tend to see the things that are so wonderful. Everything has their shadow, you know. But the Indian children get a lot more attention. They're a lot more central to the family. Family structure is still more together than ours is, and children are still more important.
Yeah, in Bali, people play with the little children.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They're amused by them in a way that they're just not.
Oh, yeah, there's so much a part of the family life. So much of it, such an important part. And they're like, that's why I used to joke, kind of, the little children, 2-3 years old, they're like these little people, important little people that have a say, you know.
Well,
so cute.
It sounds like the family is living for the children. I mean,
yeah.
It's
the children are the most cherished, central.
They sit around and be amused by these little kids.
Yeah.
Instead of go watch TV, you know.
Yeah, it's really something.
Yeah.
I'd say that's actually not uncommon here. I mean, my 5-year-old niece was just visiting this weekend, and her parents are absolutely devoted to her.
Yeah.
I mean, she's the center of everything. Everything is for her.
Yeah. In fact, we can't say that that's not human. Because I think that's human. That's just human nature. Like, we all make fun of having to go over to friends' houses who have just had a child. Because that's all we do, is sit around and stare at the baby and talk about the baby. That's what we do. That's true. But, you know, it's still a little different in India, even though that devotion is there. And parents, they're still good parents here. It's not like there aren't good parents here.
I think it's easier to keep it in balance when the families are extended, so it's not all focus on one child or two children.
Oh, I was just going to mention that too. Like, they have aunts and uncles and grandparents and so.
Isolation here affects everything.
Yeah, it does. Anyway, who knows? We don't know what we're talking about, really. Let's stop.